You know, I hope he knows that probably a majority of people really support him. So I hope he feels that.
As Carla wonders if
Hi, Tom. Hi, Chris.
Is
long time no see, Tom.
What?
Long time no see. I haven't seen
oh,
you for
I like just missed time. One meeting.
Okay, all right. It seems forever.
Every step, unparalleled safety at every visit, and flexible payment options for
everybody. Oh, I'm getting some kind of advertisement. I'm hearing.
Set of X-rays with no obligation, no insurance.
No obligation.
No obligation. Yeah.
Rich, our guest is here, Gerardo, and his
Gerardo, yes,
is scheduled for 4:10. And I know we just have a couple of items before that, but I think he's pretty locked into that time.
Okay.
And, so if we could just be mindful of that. And we do actually have a quorum, though I think we're still missing a few people. So.
Right. I saw that we had a quorum. So I was just going to wait till 4 to start.
Yeah.
And then we will be underway.
Okay, great.
So we're down one person, right?
Well, we're actually down two people. So Aaron Crawley.
Aaron and Gina.
Gina. Yeah. And we do have a person who applied who, I can't remember her name. Her name is Lita. Yes, that's right. Which reminds me, how do I tell when there are people? Well, there's 9 of us. So the attendee link is on the city's website and people can select that link and we can't see them or hear them, but they can see and hear us and we can promote them to what's called a panelist, which is what you guys all are, so that we can see and hear them. But I just have to be able to see when they come in and I must be able to see.
Okay.
I mean, we can see Gerardo, but he's in our panel, huh?
He is. Yeah, he is. Because he's presenting, I made him a panelist. And now, what have I done? Okay.
I was thinking Lori Kaplan might be here because she put in the letter.
So I don't know. We had a couple of people submit public forum
two
comments. And I believe that Ms. Kaplan submitted the same comment to, I think, all commissions for consideration. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I'm just realizing I'm in the sun here. I'm going to see if I can't close my blinds or something. Sun is so nice.
Linda, she does have very specific information, though, directly to HHS Commission. Lori does, Lori Kaplan.
Well, I'll just keep an eye out. I can see the participants, and it should tell me when there are people who are attendees and not panelists. And I don't know if you will all be able to see when they join the meeting.
Okay.
But since we're so casual, I'll probably just promote them so we can see and hear them.
Yeah, how would you know to bring them into public forum if you don't know they're there?
Well, I should know they're there. I'm not seeing them now, and it's been a while since I've done this. I'm not very good at this platform, but I think a name is going to pop up off to the side as attendees when people join as attendees. Mm-hmm. And I know we're having someone else who is planning on attending.
That makes sense.
Okay, folks, it is 4:00. And just before I open the meeting, we do have a guest, Gerardo Padilla, who is going to make a presentation before 10. So we're going to try to get all that we need to be done between that done by 4:10 so that we're timely. But I did want to, and Linda Rapon and I both want to maybe re-let you know that in April, we again vote on the chairing of the commission. And Linda and I are proposing kind of co-chairing for the next year. And so we'll make that decision in April, but the next month, Linda can be chairing. And so you can get a flavor of what two people doing it look like. So with that, I'm going to have us look at the minutes and the approval of the minutes, and probably turn to Heidi if she's got any. No, all right. So does anyone have any amendments to the minutes from the last meeting?
I've become dependent on Heidi.
Chris?
I just have one just small thing. My name was misspelled on the SOU report. That's all.
I'll change it, Chris. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Thank you.
So is there a motion to accept the January 27th minutes? Heidi moves, a second from Jackie. All in favor, wave your hands. Any opposed? The minutes are passed. So we're going to go to public forum. And Linda, do we have people signed up for public forum?
So far, not. So I don't see anyone here.
Okay, that's weird.
That didn't sound like a very good public forum, but if we don't have folks, I think we can go directly to the presentation from Gerardo Padilla.
Okay, there's an echo in here.
Yeah. I have a question.
Go ahead, Jackie.
I guess it's sort of a point of order thing. So if we've received, I have the two letters that we received in my packet. How do we address them? Because if there's person's not here, and do we read them aloud, or do we or can I would in particular like to have the suggestions from Lori Kaplan about the environment and how we can include environmental policies and a lens, include that in the lens. I'd like a discussion, so I would like to see that on our next agenda if possible.
I would say we do have, because our meeting is scheduled till 5:30 as opposed to 6. So if we are timely enough, we could put it on the agenda today.
Linda's speaking. No.
Yeah, what I was told, Rich, is that with the two public comments, we cannot talk about those because those are not on the agenda. They were not advertised as being on the agenda. But what we can do is talk about them in a successive meeting. That way, anyone else who has input can then provide that input. So, Jackie, the thing I was thinking about that comment was that we could potentially ask her to come to a meeting to talk with us more specifically, and that it also ties in with one of our goals. And so that might work out well.
I would love that. Thank you very much, Linda. And it's exactly right that it ties in with one of our goals. And so I think that would be excellent.
Okay, I'm writing it down.
Thank you.
All right.
The other thing that I should mention, though, briefly, thinking about adding things to our agenda, is that our next meeting is the March meeting. We do have two applicants for CDBG, and I'll be sending out those applications for you to review tomorrow. So there's the presentation and then the, recommendation, review and recommendation of applications. But there's only two, like I said, so it may not be as much time as we've spent in the past. And then we also have Echo Northwest coming back to get your feedback on the final or draft document, the housing, I always want to call it the housing needs analysis, but that's not what it's called. The housing
capacity.
Yes.
Capacity.
So those are the two things that are on our agenda already. But I think we probably have some room for Ms. Kaplan if we want to talk about that.
Okay. That sounds great. So we're just a little bit early from the 4:10 presentation. Gerardo, are you there? Can you unmute? Oh, he did. All right.
Hello, everyone. Good to meet you guys. Thank you so much for having me on. It's lovely to see everyone. And I just want to say a quick thank you to my manager, Billy J. Arnold at the DHS SSP White City office, who is gracious enough to allow me the time to do this today. So thank you. Is it okay if I get started?
Yes, I think you've got up to 20 minutes on the agenda. So if you want to get going and then accept questions along the way.
What I'll do is I will only be here for 15 minutes and then I'll finish out the day at the office and then I'll be back after 5 p.m. and then I'll take questions then if that's okay.
Sounds good.
Okay, so a little background. We here in Ashland, sometimes we have, at least for me, the story that inspired this presentation is we have, I see unhoused populations and there's a Safeway right here in town. And I saw some clients maybe take some items from the store and it is a grocery store. So I had the thought, it's like, wow, I wonder if he knows what the Oregon Department of Human Services self-sufficiency program can do. So he doesn't have to take food. Not only is it an uncomfortable situation for the person who is taking food, it's an uncomfortable situation for the clientele. I'm sure it's uncomfortable for the employees. And God forbid law enforcement gets involved, that's another obstacle that the individual would have to overcome in the future as they gain self-sufficiency in their life. So I spoke with Billy actually several months ago, and then the opportunity came up just recently. So I said, why not? And I asked for permission, and here we are. So just a little intro. I work with the Oregon Department of Human Services. There's several branches of the Oregon Department of Human Services. I specifically work at the Self-Sufficiency Programs branch. We refer to it as SSP. And so I will be speaking primarily about SSP programs at ODHS. And this is our logo. So we have DHS, Oregon Department of Human Services. And can everybody see my screen or no? Hello?
Yes, we can
see. We're seeing it.
Mm-hmm. You guys can see my screen okay?
Yep.
Oh, it does. It says you are sharing. Sorry, I'm also not great with Zoom. I was like, did I go disappear? So this is our logo. And then recently there is some confusion with Department of Homeland Security and Department of Human Services. So at the State of Oregon Department of Human Services level, we have started to use the vernacular ODHS instead of DHS. So if you hear some lingo coming up in the next couple months, you guys are in the know now. We're starting to change it to internally to ODHS just so that we do service some clients who do not have documents, who are not legal citizens. So we use ODHS so that it allows space to welcome conversation. So now you guys are in the know that we are shifting from a DHS nomenclature to an ODHS nomenclature. We have locations in Ashland, over by the House of Bagels, in Medford, downtown, and in White City, Oregon. So these three storefronts, we call them storefront offices, are in Jackson County, which we refer to as District 8. For anybody who has general questions and maybe doesn't want to stop by and maybe has more questions than what we would be able to answer at DHS, you're always welcome to call 211. It's a phone number that we also provide our clients. You can text this phone number and you can email here. Also, Linda has this presentation. So this presentation will be available to everyone, is available to everyone. So don't worry too much if you missed that. So self-sufficiency programs serve Oregonians of all ages through a variety of programs and partnerships. Benefits and services offered provide a safety net of services for family stability and a connection to careers aimed at reducing poverty in Oregon and stopping the cycle of poverty for next generation of Oregonians. And then the Oregon Department of Human Services, SSP, will probably refer to as benefits and assistance. And the three that we primarily work with at SSP, this is the internal that we actually process, the files that we manage, are SNAP, TANF, and ERDC. SNAP is Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that is SNAP. TANF is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, that is TANF. ERDC is Employment Related Daycare. And then the next one is, so now we're going to talk about SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. SNAP is formerly known as food stamps and provides nutritional assistance benefits to children and family, the elderly, the disabled, unemployed, and working families. SNAP helps support monthly food budgets of families to buy food they need to maintain good health and allow them to direct more of their available income towards essential living expenses, utility bills, rent, transportation. It's just taking a load off a percentage of the budget, which is great for working families and those who need assistance. ODHS staff, myself, determines the eligibility. I determine eligibility of applicants based on guidelines established by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So it is a federal department by the USDA in which funds are provided to each state. And there are certain federal policies, there's state policies, there's sometimes county policies that we have to reference in order to make sure that we're adhering to laws, rules, regulations, and policies outlined. And that's the background. And then my job is to provide a human element and have conversations and engage a client in their file. The primary goals of the program are to alleviate hunger and malnutrition and to improve nutrition and health in eligible households. So as of yesterday, this is the number. So one person, this is based off like zero income. For one person, they would receive $234. For a household of two, it would be $430. For a household of three, it would be $616. For a household of four, it would be $782 a month. And for a household of five, it would be $929. And this is based on the max. This is the max based on income calculations. And there's several different ways of the system has an algorithm for calculating income. But for easy peasy, this is based on zero income. This would be the max allotment for the group size. And so something that comes to mind for our unhoused populations is that system coding does exist for clients without residential addresses. So one time I was walking down Main Street and I had a conversation with a gentleman outside the theater. And I said, hey, you know, just so you know, there's an SSP office, a DHS office over by the bagel place, by the cinema, and this is what they can help you with. And then he kind of looked at me tearfully in the eyes and he said, I don't have an address. And that broke my heart. And you don't have to have an address. We have coding. The system is prepared for that. Policies in place for that. So you don't have to have a residential address to receive food benefits. You don't need residential address for SNAP benefits. Also, for some folks, it could be because of a fire, a flood, or unhoused, or what have you. We do require a social security number or other forms of verification. I won't get into the weeds with that, but a social security number is needed, but we do not need the physical card. Also, ID and social security numbers can be verified using internal state and federal authorized system portals. So that's another hurdle that some of the unhoused population might have, is they're not sure, they don't have an ID. We can work that out. There's coding, there's policy, there's systems in place to make sure that the whoever walks into the door and they are eligible will receive benefits. So that's something that's reassuring to myself and hopefully to the panel as well. Something that's really cool is that the SNAP Training and Employment Program, STEP, I just had a meeting with them this morning. So if a client who comes into our door is approved, which we refer to as categorically eligible, so if they're categorically eligible slash approved for SNAP, they can then, this program is voluntary, STEP, and STEP program is designed to assist individuals receiving SNAP to obtain skills, training, work experience, and employment to increase their ability to obtain living wage employment. Now, how does this look in the real world? If a person is nervous because they're applying for jobs and they don't have the right clothes, we will provide a voucher to the Goodwill for clothing for interviewing. If they need transportation to an interview, we will provide that transportation. If their car needs to have maintenance to be fixed, we don't pay for the car, but if it needs repairs, we will assist with those repairs. If a client, this just happened today, apparently the STEP program received 90 laptops in Jackson County for clients so they can attend virtual interviews or apply online. The STEP program, however, is completely voluntary. No one is required to participate in the STEP program, but we do have a conversation with the client when they are approved for the SNAP program about this wonderful thing. A case would be where I had a client who was a mom and I heard kiddos in the background. I was like, how do I explain the STEP program as quickly as possible? And I said, it's a personal assistant who will help you find a job. And that is essentially what it is. You essentially get a personal assistant. They're called step navigators, and they will help individuals find jobs based on their needs, which is amazing. I love that. And that's something that we as a community volunteer our tax dollars to provide. So it's a beautiful service. The next one is ERDC, which is employment-related daycare. The employment-related daycare program, ERDC, helps eligible families pay for childcare while they are working. ERDC is a subsidy program, meaning eligible families still pay for part of the childcare cost. So one beautiful case that I had the other day was I had a family member, an individual who was on TANF, which I will cover in a little bit, the next couple slides, who was transitioning, who just got hired, got a new hire letter, so excited, and was transitioning to ERDC. And what ERDC the state of Oregon, we as a collective society have agreed to help subsidize daycare to help a family on their journey to self-sufficiency. So what it does is it pays for the daycare costs, but it does not cover the copay. So a conversation I usually have with clients when they're approved for ERDC and they only have 45 days to link to a childcare provider is I inform them that while you're interviewing childcare centers, please ask the question of what is the copay. Some childcare centers may have a $0 copay per child, which is great. Some childcare centers might have a $10 copay per child, which is very may be doable depending on the budget. And some daycare centers may have a $200 copay, and that might blow some budgets. So I always am mindful to let the client know that we do cover the childcare costs, but we do not, at the state of Oregon, DHS does not cover the copays. And then for ERDC, this is the gross income limits that are established by the federal government. So you'll see the group size on the left. So for two people, one of them is a child, your gross income limit to qualify is 4012, so 4012. And for three, it's 4956. For four, it's 5899. For five, it's 6843. And this is the gross income. And gross income can be in a variety of ways. I won't get into the weeds with all the inputs and algorithms and questions we must ask. But essentially, if gross income equals this, and this is your household size, you do qualify for subsidized daycare. And that's to help our families on their journey towards self-sufficiency, which is the goal of our program and what we've been hired to do. The last one that I'll cover is temporary assistance for needy families, TANF. The temporary assistance for needy families provides cash assistance to low-income families with children while they strive to become self-sufficient. Cash assistance is intended to meet a family's basic needs, such as food, clothing, shelter, and utilities. Most cash benefits in Oregon are issued via an electronic benefit transfer, EBT card. This is also known as an Oregon Trail card. Eligibility: to qualify for TANF, families must have very few assets. This one is a long file to process, because not only do we look at past income and current income, we also assess assets. So there has to be almost little to no income. The current maximum monthly benefit for a family of three is $506. So there is sort of like a notion out there that TANF is a lot of money. It's not. And it takes a lot to, if you're a family of three and you have a minimum wage job and your hours were cut or et cetera, and you're grossing more than $506, you do not qualify for TANF. So that sometimes is a hard conversation to have with our clients. So TANF pursuing assets, there's a lot of dots that I also didn't know before joining DHS. So it is necessary to work with families to understand what assets they may have to accurately determine eligibility. In the TANF program, individuals must actively pursue any assets they have legal right or claim to. So unless there is good cause not to pursue. So unemployment, Social Security, disability. Part of the way that the policy is set up is those assets must be pursued before TANF can be approved, which sometimes is a hard conversation to have with families. Note, if the person is a survivor of oppression from domestic violence, and pursuing assets will put them or their children at risk of further or future violence, they are given what is called good cause from pursuing available assets. So that is something that is a conversation that we have for clients. It is a tough conversation to have, but we are trained and we have it nonetheless. And it is crucial because we don't ever want to put a family or an individual in danger. So Division of Child Support Cooperation. So TANF applicants and recipients will need to cooperate with the Division of Child Support. This is another policy that comes in, DCS, to pursue child support and assign child support collected to DCS. So and something else is like, oh, well, people, individual clients who receive TANF are just receiving free money, not necessarily. If there is a possibility of child support assets being pursued, there is a form. And if those child support assets start to get funneled in, the state of Oregon will will reclaim those assets. So it's not just like a freebie. By signing the application, participants' rights to child support are assigned to the state. So if there is a possibility of child support being paid out, the participant assigns those benefits to the state to be collected in the future. Funding, fun. We're getting to the end. ODHS, Oregon Department of Human Services, SSP, Self-Sufficiency Programs, gets funding from several sources for its services. The Oregon legislature appropriates general funds, that's us, the taxpayer dollars, so congratulations, you're all contributing to a beautiful cause, based on forecasted program caseloads and costs. So it's all forecasted and it's a projection. Services are also funded by several federal grants, the largest being SNAP, TANF, and the Child Care ERDC, CCDF. I will get into that one. So now for SNAP funding. SNAP funds food assistance provided through the EBT card is 100% federal funding. It is considered an entitlement program for Americans, which means that if a household meets the federal eligibility requirements, they are entitled to those benefits. There are also some education training services under SNAP, which require the state through the general fund to pay part of those costs. So that would be something like the STEP program. So that is definitely paid by our general fund here in the state of Oregon. TANF. TANF is the federal grant that provides the TANF cash assistance. It is a capped grant, meaning that the amount Oregon receives was calculated years ago and does not change. If Oregon's caseload goes up, there isn't additional federal funding, so the state must pay out of the general fund. Parts of the cash assistance payments don't meet the federal requirements. For example, in the state of Oregon, the TANF, we code it as UN. I won't get into the weeds, but that is something we code, which stands for two-parent family. So the TANF program that has two parents is a state-funded program. So it's funded by the general fund. Families which have been on TANF longer than the federal limit, there are limits to being on TANF, we call them time limits. In most cases, the Oregon Department of Human Services will have to use a state general fund for those cash benefits. So again, we as collective members of Oregon society have decided that this would be the best route to help our families in need and gain self-sufficiency. So the Child Care Development Fund, CCDF, is a federal grant that pays for childcare. It is actually received by the Early Learning Division, who transfers some of it over to us, the state of Oregon, to help fund the employment-related daycare program at ODHS. CCDF is also a capped grant. So several years ago, the state legislature made, the state of Oregon legislature made an additional investment of state general funds into the program. So we also contribute towards it. ERDC is possible through a mixture of federal and state funding. And then here are some links. They're not live. Oh, they are. They're very live. But Linda has this presentation, so they'll be live on the PowerPoint as well. And then Linda also has a PDF, a PowerPoint, and a keynote for Apple users. And then if you want to apply or if you are curious of what the application portal looks like, this is the link. And if you want to contact, you're always welcome to call 211 for general questions. You can text, email. And then also, it's important that I want to communicate that at Oregon Department of Human Services, specifically in Jackson County, we take a lot of effort to make sure that not only are we knowledgeable and capable in these programs, the SNAP, ERDC, and TANF, but also we do a lot of community, we take meetings to make sure that we're well connected to nonprofits, non-government organizations to help our clients when they don't qualify for services or if the services that we provide are not enough for our clients. We have ongoing conversations with different programs here throughout the Rogue Valley to help our clients of different backgrounds. So yeah, if you know someone and they need some help towards self-sufficiency, just let us know. And I'm gonna stop sharing. And thank you so much for all of your time. And again, thank you, Billy, for allowing me to share this information, which I think is super valuable. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Do you have time for a couple of questions from folks?
Not at the moment. I had a 15-minute break and now it's over at 4:30, but I will be back at 5. And you're also welcome to type up questions, and Linda has my email, but I'll jump back in at 5:00. I'm going to get back to policy. See you guys soon.
Thanks, Gerardo.
Thanks, Gerardo. So when he comes back in, I guess he'll come back in through the same thing. So we'll see that he's here. And if you want, we can just maybe skip the next agenda item and go to a question and answer if you guys would prefer. Jackie?
I just noticed there is one attendee. I didn't know if that was Billy or, there is a one up there.
Where is it? Where are you seeing this?
I have my chat open and there are 11 panelists and one attendee, and it wasn't Gerardo.
I am not seeing it. I have my chat open. Why can't I see it?
There is no name, but it says 11 panelists and I can see all the panelists, and then it says attendees one at the top. But
there, I just changed it. I see it. It's
okay. So, I just wanted you to know.
Thank you. No, it's Lita, the woman who has applied to join the commission.
Okay, very good.
I'm going to go ahead and, now there's two. Oh, okay. Michael Duffy, whom I know. Hi, Michael. do you guys want me to just make them visible? How do you feel about that? Is that easier for you? I'm going to go ahead and.
I think yes.
Okay. So for those of you that I am promoting to attendees so that we can see you, you'll be kicked out of the meeting briefly. I mean, it'll just kind of go black, but then it'll pop you right back in. Okay.
Welcome. Welcome to our attendees as well. Michael, I see you're coming in, and people are muted at the moment. I did want to just introduce the next piece on the agenda, which is really going to be quite important for us, the Racial Justice and Housing Template Review and Discussion. I know I have a lot of interest in this, and I think we all do, but Echo is going to lead us in this discussion with some presentation or information about this, right?
Sure.
Okay.
So in your packet, and I don't know if everybody had time to look at it, but what I'm going to talk about is really just from the document, the PDF, that is included in your packet. So all of the details are there when you have time to look at it. It's titled Using Human Rights Assessment in Local Governance. So it certainly focuses on issues of racial justice and equity, but it's also applicable to any kind of policy that would have an impact on less advantaged communities, people in subordinate statuses, whether it's race, class, gender identity, et cetera, disability. So it can all be extrapolated. I think this document, it's from 2014, by the way, and it was prepared by the Columbia Law School of Human Rights for the International Association of Official Human Rights Agencies. I have not looked up to see how successfully the models, the examples of assessment tools have been used in the places that you see in the document. Those places are Portland, Eugene, and then there's a couple of samples from Seattle. And they vary in the extent to which they're detailed. I think this document has usefulness, not only for our commission, but absolutely for the Racial Justice and Inclusion Commission. I forget exactly what we're calling that at the moment, but Gina knows. So Gina, I think of it as Gina's commission. So I think Gina, that when you have a chance to look at that PDF, you may want to share it with the folks on the council who are working on trying to get that commission going. Because it is the kinds of questions that I know that we need to ask about housing, and frankly, about every other kind of policy that comes up for consideration in the city. So
I wanted to say something really quick. I wanted to thank you for this, because when I read it, the name of the commission is Racial and Social Equity Commission. And when I was reading this, I thought, oh my God, this is what we need. You've done all the work. There's so much information here.
Yeah.
And I appreciate it. And hopefully we can work together and look through one lens that is inclusive of all of us, all the commissions, all the residents of Ashland. So, yeah.
And I think what's really helpful is when we use the word lens, which I do use too, is that we know exactly what lens involves in specifically, what it involves focusing on specifically. So what a human rights, social justice, broadly construed lens means that we're looking for, and I'm just sort of summarizing key points from this document, means that we focus on quality of outcome of a policy or a proposal, not just the intention behind it, but the actual outcomes. And then whether or not those outcomes are consistent with values and the stated purposes. It involves looking at disparate impact on particularly marginalized communities, regardless of the intention behind a policy. Unintended consequences bite us in the butt all the time, and particularly when it comes to these issues. A critical issue is the participation of stakeholders, and that is directly relevant to one of the pieces of email that I was skimming that's in our packet for this week. Mm-hmm. Having all stakeholders at the table in contributing to a discussion of, for example, disparate impact is really critical, and that can be really difficult with some folks who don't have conventional addresses and have obstacles to communication, but you know, getting everybody who's going to be affected by a policy included early on in the formation of policy is important. The sun just went down, so now I don't have sun in my eyes. It's great. Transparency and accountability. I think everybody's striving for that. Whether it's, I see Chris shaking his head at the university, that's certainly true. We don't have a lot of trust in our society right now. And transparency and accountability are ways, goals to work towards for trying to restore trust. Progressive realization, it means making it real, and that's another trust issue. If we see that there's a housing trust fund, if we see that there's an affordable housing initiative happening in the city, but nothing really seems to happen, it just seems to be talk, then all that does is to further erode trust, and it further fertilizes this, I'm getting poetic now, it further fertilizes the seeds of cynicism. I don't know why it came out that way. So people have to, particularly folks who are going to supposedly be benefited by a policy, need to be able to see that those benefits are real in their lived experience. Consultation has to happen. This is another point in this document. It has to happen every step of the way so that people feel that they can really support a policy and initiative, can really have buy-in. So the policy or the program has genuine legitimacy among members of the community. And one way you do that is to make sure that you anticipate problems to prevent them rather than waiting for them to happen, rather than waiting for the crisis to happen, rather than waiting for the train wreck to happen and then responding to it after the fact. We've all just lived through the last year of a shining example of what happens when prevention and anticipating a problem gets shoved in a drawer someplace. And we have been left with this train wreck called a pandemic instead. It's just a large scale example of the same problem. So the trick is to be proactive rather than reactive. Really what this document does is to outline some basic principles of good program evaluation. Mm-hmm. So program evaluation in the formation process of creating a program or policy, program evaluation in the implementation of a program or policy, and then ongoing program evaluation as time goes on to make sure that the program is learning from its mistakes and continues to evolve and adapt to its environment. That's all really difficult to do because, as we all know, we've lived this. Every single one of us in this group has lived this. It requires ongoing attention and time, and time means somebody's work and somebody's money. But when we don't do it, wheels fall off, people get disappointed, and cynicism grows. So in order to do sort of achieve all of these goals, the templates that you see in the document are varyingly detailed approaches to gathering the data that's needed to do the kind of front-end evaluation and then the ongoing evaluation after implementation. I get worried when I see some of this because I feel for Linda Reed, who's, you know, a dedicated staff person, and these templates ask a lot of staff, some of them more than others, would ask a lot of staff in terms of gathering the information. And I'm really cognizant of that as an issue. So whatever we do around having some kind of formal process for racial justice, social justice, for having a good lens on these issues, I think we have to be realistic about staff time as well. And I think that's pretty much all that I want to say. I don't know if folks want to maybe talk about some of these specific templates.
I think we will. I think raising your hand is a good one. I have a motion I'm going to make at the end, but
okay.
Jackie, do you want to start first?
Yeah. Pick one.
Yeah, I do have some feedback from Eugene.
Oh, good.
About the triple bottom line.
Yeah.
They've been using it for 10 years, I believe. And a friend of mine who, in fact, it's Lori Kaplan, called up there and talked with got some information from Samantha Roberts, who's the climate policy analyst. And then she gave information from Don Ruiz, who is the previous city manager in Eugene, and then mentioned Sarah Metairie, who is the new city manager. And they have very positive comments for many reasons about the triple bottom line tool. As you read this, you can see, thinking of Linda and practicality of things, the triple bottom line is both a short form. You can use a short form, and then you can also use the long form. And what the Eugene folks were saying was that we have these concepts, the three concepts of social equity, economic prosperity, and environmental health, woven. So those are woven together in the tool, and it's baked into all their commissions and all of their decisions. So it's across, it's overarching, and they've been using it long enough that they feel it is, it's very effective. It's also flexible. It is, you know, 10, 11 years old. However, they don't feel it's outdated. They have no desire to change that up. And I was thinking, you know, while we're trying to do our goals, it seems so hard to cover everything in, you know, in housing and human services. Sometimes you're looking at social equity, you know, you're looking at, you know, the economy, you know, of how this, all the housing fits into the, to the neighborhoods. And then the environment seems to get left out, I think, a lot of times is how it seems to me. And this one puts it together, all three. And you can choose to go in depth, or you can choose to go more with the short form. So I was extremely impressed with the triple bottom line and would love to look at it with the group more moving forward.
Yeah, and thanks for, you know, doing that follow up, because that's something that I hadn't done and was really curious about. And I think the phrase triple bottom line has been used now long enough in a lot of different places, including schools of business, that phrase is no longer so scary as it would have been 10 years ago. Well, I think a lot of people have familiarity with it.
I would just say that it's also slightly confusing. The term got used a lot by John Kitzhaber in healthcare. So the Archimedes movement and all those folks used the triple bottom line of three pieces of healthcare. So, but it's a good bottom line, but I'm just saying there are two of them out there.
Yeah, I think, you know, another example of a word that gets used in ways that can be confusing because it's so varied is the word sustainability. Because frequently sustainability came to mean just environmental, meaning natural resources sustainability, when in fact, the word gets used to mean socially sustainable and economically sustainable and social justice sustainability. So we do have to be really precise about exactly nuts and bolts of what we mean when we use phrases like these. That's really true.
And it is very well defined in the long tool, exactly what they're saying about social equity, for instance, meeting basic human needs, and then bulleted on how that would be addressing inequities and being inclusive. And there are 10 bullets there. Number three is ensuring community safety. There's bullets there. Culture. And then there are bullets there. Addressing the needs of neighborhoods. I really liked that neighborhood concept. Bullets there. The building capacity to advance social equity and steps and questions regarding that. So that's just the one piece of social equity. It's very well described, I think, if you look at it. I don't think it would be confusing at all when you see how it's laid out.
Yeah.
Linda, and then others should figure out if you want to join in on this conversation. And then in a moment, I'd like to make a motion in relation to all this. But Linda, go ahead.
So I was just going to say thank you, Echo, for being cognizant of staff time. I do really appreciate that. And I also wanted to say that, Jackie, this was my preference out of all of the options, partially because of the short form, although, I mean, there's similarities, but it just feels very inclusive. And then just, I don't actually know how these things fit in, but I'm just going to say them because they're what come to mind. We have done a... HUD required us to do a barrier removal exercise a long time ago. We did it, I think, in 2008, which was to review our code to see if there were any barriers to specifically HUD required things, which really were about affordable housing and manufactured housing, not environmental as much or social justice as much, except with regard to sort of those populations that HUD is wanting, cities that receive entitlement funds to make sure that we're not leaving out, which happens to be low-income minority populations, those kind of things. And then a little later, there was more of a push toward that sort of planning with a social justice lens. So now as part of the environmental review process, there is a whole new section that is called the social justice section. So when using federal funding to fund affordable housing projects, whether that be the purchase of a new, piece of land to build affordable housing on or an existing, you know, complex to convert to affordable housing, you have to do an environmental review. And the social justice piece does talk about a lot of environmental impacts, but also like access to services, access to transportation. So it is much more holistic. So I feel like that's being woven in to some extent. And then obviously, as you guys probably well remember, we are required to do an analysis of impediments to fair housing choice and to tie actions with regard to fair housing to our consolidated plan each year. And so one of the actions that we identified was to review city policies to make sure that they meet a sort of EDI lens. And then also to try to do work to include and engage more of those organizations that provide services to BIPOC communities or underserved communities that maybe haven't traditionally been as included. And so I do see some parallel with that work that we are, we essentially told HUD we would be doing in the next 5 years with implementing something like this. And I'm not sure where it would apply necessarily, you know, with this new commission coming on board. I don't know if this will fall under their purview, because the city is doing more EDI work and has that commitment that is actually being taken over by a different department. And so I think there's room for us to interface. I'm just not sure, how that will work or what that will look like. But I just wanted to mention those items because I feel like there's room for this and that there's some tie-in. We'll just have to do some more work to figure out how that meshes with the work you're doing.
But I was thinking as I was reading this is that it's really an agenda for shaping the thinking of everybody who's making policy in the city. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So it's the kinds of issues, the kinds of questions, call it a lens, if you will, that everybody in city council needs to have on the surface of their brain, no matter what the policy is, whether it's, you know, not necessarily directly to housing or to racial justice and social equity, but really everything that we do. Because if we're going to really walk our talk around creating more systemic justice, then it means everybody has to have these questions on the forefront of their brain and to ask them of whatever a proposal is. So transparency, accountability, stakeholder involvement, ongoing progressive realization, that whole list is something that I think everybody in the city, including just people who live here as part of the community. We have to get used to thinking in those terms.
Yeah, Jackie, and then I'd like it to hear from other people. We've heard sure. from two people a lot. But,
yeah.
Okay, can I
just say...
Jackie raised her hand and then Tom next.
Okay.
Yeah. I just want to say, I think it would be really great because we're looking at overarching, I think, a policy and procedures kind of thing. If the new city manager, you know, when they come into place, that they would be able then to work with the council and the commission so that there's an overarching tool that, as Echo was saying, you use it in the city council decisions and programs, you use it in the commissions, and then you use it through the city manager with all the departments. So that's how I was looking at these and trying to figure out how could you have an overarching assessment tool that could be used everywhere, baked in. Okay, I'll be quiet now.
Well, I'm somewhat skeptical because as I read through each of the sections from the different cities, I agree, and I think a lot of people agree with those as being very good values that we ought to dictate what kinds of policies we implement. But I'm skeptical because there's always reality out there. Oh, we can't do this because HUD won't let us. We don't have the money for that. Or we can't change these rules because Ashland is doesn't have the authority to change these requirements. And there's all kinds of ways around this, but I'd like to see some of the issues that have been addressed in Eugene or Portland or Seattle that actually worked, and see what the proponents of these systems can show us in terms of this counteracting my skepticism.
Okay. Well, wait a minute. Gina, did you have your hand up? You're muted.
Yes, but let's hear from Heidi first.
Okay, Heidi and then Gina. Heidi, you're up.
I struggled with trying to figure out how we could implement this in the things that we do as a commission. And just in reading over the list of, gender, age, religion, national origin, in CDBG grant funding, we asked how many men, how many women, what were their ages, and we really know so little about each organization in terms of how inclusive they are based on such small askings. And I struggled to think of how can we implement this into everything we do. And it seems like we could have some kind of form that goes out with the social service grants that asks some of these questions that would give us a better idea of how inclusive a program it is. The problem I see with Ashland is we have such a small, diverse, racially diverse population. And I know we have more people in poverty out there. And when I was on the school board, I was really astounded at how much poverty and Title I, people who qualify for Title I services in our community, but it's sort of hidden. So you really have to dig deeply to get people to acknowledge it and to, I'm confused about this. I can see that it relates greatly to policy, but I also don't want us to give grants to organizations that aren't thinking along these lines. So I'm confused.
Okay, Gina and then me. And then Chris. Okay,
I'll be quick. And you know what? Thank you so much, everyone, because at the end of our meetings, there's this little phrase. It's like 10 or 15 minutes. It says council liaison report. And I thought to myself, my first thing I'm going to do is ask you, what do you need from me? And I'm listening to this feedback from everyone today, and I hear confusion, obstacles, and hope. And so hearing from you, what I think I hear from you and what we need, when I hear about obstacles, they're always going to be there, Tom. And I love the idea of hearing, let's see what they did so we can find a solution. I love what you said, Heidi. How do we connect with all these people out there? Because it is hard to get that information. However, we have to start somewhere, and we're starting somewhere. I too loved Eugene's packet of information and how it overlapped and it cross-pollinated. And that's what I'm hoping, that by the Housing and Human Services Commission doing this, it will work in concert with the Social and Racial Equity Commission, because we are all together in this. And I hope to have one of us, or one of you, one of us, on that commission, because we need everybody's voice and everyone at the table. Thank you.
Okay, Chris, go ahead, and then I'll finish with my recommendation.
All right, thanks, Rich. So the biggest takeaway that I got is that each one of these toolkits was very, very viable. It had lots of great stuff in them. You know, of course, a lot of these were proactively trying to address the source of inequality, and I appreciate that in all the toolkits that I read. The biggest concern that I was thinking about is the accountability piece. Like, okay, once we identify where these inequalities are at, what's the go-to procedure on how we address that? Is it through policy change at the city level? Is it addressing it, you know, on the state level? There's like so many layers and barriers that, you know, of course, need addressing that keep this inequality being reinforced even at the city level here. So, you know, I just want to kind of bring that point that I think it does a great job of proactively kind of like looking for those inequalities. But what's the, you know, go-to, you know, pattern when we see that inequality take place here at the city level?
Thank you. Well, I would just like to start. I've been thinking about this for some time. I'm part of a few organizations that have made a racial justice lens fundamental to the work that they do. And it starts with a agreement amongst the groups that is going to be a racial and social equity lens that they use. I would say in Ashland, we don't have a very we have a very inequality city. And part of that is because housing has been, the housing policy, the zoning, every piece of that has been baked in with racism over the years. And so when racial justice or the racial social equity commission got proposed, one of the pieces is housing, but it has 6 or 7 other pieces, and they're proposing a 7-person commission, which we've got 9. I don't know how much work they're going to be able to do with really unpacking the huge amount of racial justice issues that are in our housing work. We could. And so my proposal is that, and this is, I think, slightly different than yours, Jackie, because I think if we need to separate it from the environmental issues and think so it doesn't get watered down, this is a fundamental piece for housing on racial and social equity. And then we can take a look at the environmental issues. And if we want to make a lens for that, or how we want to do it, we could do it. But if you put them all into one thing, I don't think we're going to get there. So this is the this is the motion that I was going to make, and y'all can consider it or not. I would say I move that the Ashland Housing and Human Services Commission adopt the use of a racial equity lens as a process for analyzing and diagnosing the impact of commission decisions by paying attention to race, ethnicity, and underserved marginalized individuals and groups to identify and eliminate barriers. And then I would have a racial equity lens can be used with other lenses. You could use it with like about the environmental issues, but a racial equity lens sheds light on the racial dynamics that shape social, economic, and political structures. So in the organizations, Unite Oregon, in So Equity and or So Healthy, they have really decided that a use of a racial and social equity lens is fundamental. And so that's my proposal as a motion.
Rich, can you say that one more time, the motion?
Or if you read it,
I'll email it or send it to you, Liz.
Exactly. Okay.
If people want me to read it again, I will. But I think that we could be ready for some discussion too about whether we want to
do that. I would like to second the motion.
Linda seconds it. Heidi, unmute.
I would like to see that in writing. And I would say for Housing and Human Services Commission, I just think environmental sustainability is really an important lens to put on housing trust fund monies. I think I like all three of, racial, social justice, racial equity. Those are also important, but I wouldn't take out environmental sustainability given that our work is around housing as well as social services. So I just think your proposal needs to be a little broader.
Okay. Jackie.
One thing that I would be happy to do is the brand new Eugene Mayer is sending a memo to the city council about the perspectives of the sustainability commission using the triple bottom line tool. And I couldn't get it because hadn't been released yet to the council, but it is coming to them like tonight or something. So I just want to let you know, I can send you, because it talks about how they have been using it and what they think about it, is it working well in Eugene? And, you know, Eugene is the one that has cahoots. They have incredible levels of housing options, particularly in terms of shelter and temporary housing and supportive housing. And so I hear you, Rich, and I certainly support the concept of what you're saying. So I wonder, you know, it's like the motion is a philosophy that we're adopting. I agree with Heidi that we should be including the environment in this as well. So I'm not against it at all. I'm also trying to look at the tool and the practicality, and I wonder, are we ready yet? But I hear you, and I certainly support having a racial equity, social justice lens. So.
Can I just want to point out that I did put the exact wording in the chat.
Oh, okay.
So if anybody wants to look at it. Echo.
I have two questions. I frequently don't know exactly what people mean when they say environment. It's a word that takes on a lot of different meanings depending upon context. So I think I'd want to hear more about, for example, what Jackie's thinking about specifically under the heading environment.
Well, I mean,
my second point is that I personally think we have to take an intersectional approach to looking at equity. So that means how race interacts with social class, how social class and race interact with gender, sexuality, and age. So the downside of thinking intersectionally, of course, is that it makes things complicated, and the forms start to sort of get really long and huge, and I'm not sure how to resolve that, but I think we have to be a little careful about looking at any of these particular vectors of inequality in isolation from each other. So that's all I wanted to say. Jackie, what you were going to ask? Sorry.
Well, again, you know, going back to the triple bottom line, they specify, you know, six different areas of environmental health. And then they have to, what does that mean? What does environmental impact mean? What does climate change mean?
Okay.
What does it mean to protect, preserve, and restore? They have pollution prevention, and then they have rethink, replace, reduce, reuse, and recirculate, recycle. And then they have the emphasis of local. And so those are six areas. And then each of those are broken down and explained. So
yeah, that's really helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
Other discussion? So, Heidi.
I would like us to wait to vote on this and to really think about what we want to include as, I think, sort of a template of all the decisions, a lens that we're going to use for our decisions that we make as a commission. So I don't feel ready to vote on adopting one component of that yet.
So Linda Rapon, should we withdraw the motion? You would second it.
Sure.
We can sort of postpone that motion. And then at the next meeting, we should have something that lays out another formulation of it. I guess I'm still against it in the sense that I think that race always gets trumped. And the reason that we don't move in Ashland, there's a lot of movement on the environment and climate change, and they've got a commission on it, and they're asking everybody to how every area of the community is dealing with climate change, and we're providing that. Race is not discussed in enough ways, and we have a commission that's come out there, and my concern that we'll take up next meeting is that we pass something that's so large that again, Ashland is allowed to not deal with the crucial issues of race and inequality. So that's my concern. So Linda.
Well, I guess I want to agree with that. I would like to consider, Heidi, a separate motion on each lens so that we really get to focus on what does that lens mean? Because I think what you're saying is let's have one motion that includes the environment, all of the lenses we want to be making decisions through. And I guess what I would suggest is that we agree to bring each of those to the table, but that they each get their own motion.
Echo.
Yeah, and I think I'd push for a poverty lens. I'm thinking back now to Gerardo's presentation earlier in the meeting. And those folks that they serve at ODHS, I will now call it that, are a marginalized community. And as Heidi knows from being on the school board, the percentage of Ashland kids who live in poverty households is much higher than most people think. And a lot of those poverty households happen to be white families. And they're the white working poor. So even though they may have racial privilege, their class position disadvantages them. So my position is that we need to have equity between the forms of inequity that we address in the way we think about these issues.
So if you look at the written motion that I put in the chat box.
I don't see it in the chat box, by the way, Rich.
We'll send it out to everybody, but it's in there and it does have that in there as part of the motion. But I think we're gonna move to the next meeting, and Heidi or Jackie, do you guys want to take charge of bringing something in and maybe sharing something ahead of time that we could look at to add to the discussion that we've had now?
Go ahead, Heidi, go ahead.
I would just like everyone to sort of reflect on this conversation and take a stab at writing something for the commission, and we can then see what people think and choose from, you know, something I think more inclusive, either by individual issues, or, you know, what I personally am looking for is a template that I can use as I'm looking at grant applications, and as we have proposals for the use of housing trust fund monies, that I can say, oh, economic sustainability, racial and social justice and equity, or environmental sustainability, you know, and maybe even subheadings under each of those. But I'm looking for a tool that's easier for me to use, that reminds me of all each of those issues that I can then apply to every grant proposal that we get.
Amen.
So, Rich, can I just jump in really briefly? I mean, we are at our next meeting, we will be reviewing grants, and I was going to mail out the grants to you tomorrow, along with our standard tool that goes with CDBG grants, which is very like CDBG oriented. And so it does feel like we could, in that grant review process, sort of think about how those things would apply to the projects that we're looking at now. I mean, not that we would be applying them now, but that we could have some real life examples of, here are proposals that are put together that are moving forward, and how would this work for them? I do have a little bit of concern about the unintended consequences of adding things to projects. So if we say that we are wanting you to do something in a more environmentally sustainable way, or we want you to consider these issues, then would that make the projects not happen? So, I mean, I think that's a discussion that would need to be had around that. You know, the environmental review process that is required by HUD is often seen as by grantees as a huge barrier to even utilizing federal funds. They just don't want to do it because it adds costs and it adds time and delays. And in some instances, it just rules out whole pieces of property. Like, here's this piece of viable flat land that we could build housing on, but now, because of the environmental review process, it's off the table. It's not even an option. And so it sometimes is seen as a barrier. So I think that we should keep that in mind when we look at those. And then the other piece that I would propose moving forward, and I don't know if this is something you would be interested in, and I'll email this out to you. There is a fair housing training for advocates. It's posted on the city's website. We do have a fair housing staff person here now. And a lot of this, I mean, in looking at the Eugene, well, all of them, all of the protected classes listed, or all of the, you know, populations listed are actually protected classes who are covered by fair housing law, but only through housing transactions. So not as broad as the application that we want to use, but they do have a lot of tools at the Fair Housing Council that they have created for a variety of circumstances. And I don't know if they might be able to provide us with some assistance in that way. As you know, they have a bunch of toolkits. They do have a toolkit for land use as well. So I don't know if you would have any interest in exploring some of those options.
I think it would be great to get more educated on what's out there. I know the Eugene model, the triple bottom line, is being used in several other cities as well. So, you know, I think it would be interesting to get feedback on, not just, you know, it doesn't have to be just that one. That happens to be the one that to me would be able to be applicable quickly and also have the long form, so it's very clear what the areas are we're talking about. But I just feel like we need more education than just this one meeting.
Does this feel like an agenda item for... The thing that I'm going to say, though, is that it would have to be April, because our March meeting is already getting full.
Well, I think go ahead and put it on April. But I think in between, we can send materials to Linda Reed, and she can send them out to us. We can't send them to each other, apparently. And use those as thought pieces and discussion for April, because we can already see the barriers that are in the way of us getting going on these things. And that's what we're trying to eliminate, is those barriers. And we're already seeing a bunch of them. So we've got two significant issues more to deal with on the rest of the meeting. So I think we can move to the next piece on the agenda, which is the goal setting and review of prioritization. So Linda, were you gonna have something that we could look at? And
Did you want to pause a moment and go back to Gerardo and see if there are any questions?
Okay.
For him? Because I believe he's back.
Any questions? Chris.
So I have a question, and this is in relation to the impact of COVID, of course, you know, with the supermarkets sharply increasing their prices for food. And I want to say it's like 3.5% increase. How does that impact, and have you seen an increase, of course, of applicants for anything from SNAP to TAF?
Hi, Chris. Yes, thank you. So the numbers that I posted for benefit, I'll share my screen really quick. So for one person, it was $234. This is actually, and please let me know if you can see my screen. For SNAP, for the $234 for one person, that's actually a new number that was just updated, I think, a month and a half ago. The old number was $194 per person. And then, so every group size went up. It was 194. The other thing that happened was, let's say a client is categorically eligible, which means you're approved. You could, based on income and calculations and algorithms, be categorically approved or categorically eligible for $1 benefit a month. So one person could technically just receive $1 in benefits because that's the algorithm based on income calculations and inputs. But what happened during the COVID pandemic is that regardless of income and regardless of eligibility for a specific number, so let's say a client was categorically eligible at a benefit amount of $1 and they were one person, during the COVID pandemic, that was waived. And if you are categorically eligible, you will be receiving the max benefit amount for your group size. So if you're one person and you're categorically eligible at $1, you will receive $1 deposit on your normal day. And then they usually come out in the middle of the month, and then at the end of the month, depending on when. Some people, for example, just applied last week, so they'll be receiving it. It'll show up tomorrow. You'll receive a second deposit to bring you up to the max benefit amount for your group size. So that person who received $1 on the first of the month would receive $233, a second deposit of $233 a week and a half later. Great question.
And is there any data to back up the demographics of Ashland and those folks who are using it?
I'm sure there are. I'm very positive that there is a department that analyzes data, because we have to do projections and we have to submit that data to the state and to the federal government. So yes, I'm absolutely sure that there is a department that has access to that information. I mostly do eligibility work, so I do processing, I do intakes, I do clients. Interactions, and I make sure that everything aligns with policy, because our branches and our programs are reviewed by the state and by the federal government. I make sure that everything is okay.
Okay, other questions? Echo, we got to move fast, so go ahead.
Okay, two questions. Because COVID has had this disastrous impact on employment, what's happening with adjusting the time limits for TANF? For people who are experiencing prolonged unemployment?
Yeah, so what happened with TANF is that at first it was a little confusing as to what was going on. There was a decision that was made that renewals will just automatically happen. So folks who were on SNAP, their program, their file is supposed to automatically renew. And we aren't doing so many renewal intakes. That's a specific form every 6 months. So there's a lot of software maintenance that's going on as well at the moment to make sure the system isn't accidentally kicking people off. So right now renewals are suspended and they're ongoing. And that is kind of a month per month conversation. Your second question, I'm sorry.
Vaccinations for folks in your caseload. What are you seeing with their access to vaccines?
Vaccinations right now, I can't speak too much about that. I can let you know that there is a rollout that is happening. And as far as ODHS employees, those that could are being sourced to work remote. And the folks that are being prioritized are our APD, which works with our older populations, and also our child welfare division at ODHS, because they are live client facing. Most of us who work administrative roles are working from home.
Great, thank you.
Heidi.
Our undocumented residents of Oregon eligible for any of the funds that you administer?
So that's a very specific definition. You can be, not a citizen of the United States and receive benefits. For example, if you are a refugee, if you were admitted into this country under refugee status, there's actually a very specific TANF-like program for refugees, citizens, and that is part of ODHS refugee branch. And they do qualify for SSP programs, which I work with, but those are also handled by the refugee division of ODHS. As far as legal permanent residence holders, they do qualify for SSP programs based on certain criteria. So yes, and then this whole benefit group size, for example, too, there could be like a family with a mom and dad and children. And what would happen in that situation is if the parents or the guardians of the children do not have LPRs and do not have U.S. citizenship, the children are fully eligible for complete benefits. So they would still qualify for SSP program benefits.
And what kind of reporting goes along with that?
There's no reporting.
Okay.
Okay, if we're...
So people don't get busted by ICE at the DHS office.
No, but you know, it was a little weird during the fires this past season. I did work at the, volunteer to work at the FEMA camps that were happening, and I did see some parents who... you know, did seek legal counsel, and I'm not a lawyer, so I can't offer legal advice, nor do I offer legal advice. But they were advised by NGO legal advisors that they shouldn't do it because they could be cited or tracked or something. So yeah, we don't, but obviously nothing in this world is like 100%, but we do not. And the legal advice that I heard from some clients was that they would rather not there's a whole bunch of factors that play into different things. So I had some clients who decided not to.
Thank you.
Okay, so moving on to the next agenda. Linda, do you wanna talk about our review and prioritization of our goal setting?
Sure, so that is in your packet and I did not put page numbers. But it should be about page 84, and it's actually out of order. So I apologize for that. It's after the Housing Trust Fund item. And this is just based on the conversation that we had on December 10th in going through the existing goals and talking about which to keep and how to sort of expand or contract the existing goals. But one thing that I realized later, we did also talk in the mental health section about partnering with NAMI to do a training, which was on the goal list from the prior year. And we have talked a little bit about potentially doing a virtual training with them. So that did not get put on this list, but I can amend that. So it's really just for your review and approval or to refine it or prioritize it better. I know that December was a long time ago. I actually had to re-watch the meeting to draft this because it just felt like it was a long time ago and I didn't remember all that we discussed. Tom?
Yes, and looking at these goals, they're all laudable and they're all identify important issues, but and I said this before, we do this every year and we either take credit for something getting accomplished or extend it, but we haven't focused in on an actual plan to accomplish a specific thing that the commission has the power to push forward or to fund or to somehow get a tangible result. And one of the things, I can't think of many, but we want, one year we wanted to get porta potties in different parts of the city, and I think we accomplished that. I think we accomplished activating the housing trust fund and getting a project which is not yet started, but that was a major accomplishment. And there have been others, but I'd like to see us focus on something that we have the power to implement, or at least study it and bring it to the forefront. So that's just a comment on the process.
Other comments? Do we want to just affirm the goals that we laid out? Tom, in response to your thing, I think one of the things that we have as another kind of fundamental decision is the level of work that people are prepared to do outside of a 2-hour meeting. And almost everything where we've been very successful at, almost every one of them have been as a result of work groups that have met outside and then come back for affirmation and planning. And so I think that we shouldn't do it right on tonight's meeting. We're 25 minutes from over that, but the notion of looking at those goals again and deciding which one of those can be part of work groups, and really then it becomes who's willing to volunteer to do that work outside of that regular meetings. And I'm for it, but I think that's a big decision that we have to make.
I agree.
Linda.
I feel like we need to go ahead and adopt these priorities, partly because that has been one of the ways we reviewed grant applications, is where those applications fit within our priorities. And now, because it's already March and we haven't adopted it yet, we're just about to do that. And so I feel like we need them. I'm not satisfied that we really have given this what I would like to see us give it. We were sort of hurried at the end of the December meeting, and now it's actually 3 months later when we're making a decision. And so I would just like to encourage us to think next year about a process that will get us to really wrap our early and make decisions. I guess
we need you're freezing, yes, Linda.
Sorry.
Yeah, you froze a little.
I don't know if you heard what I was saying. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I feel like we need to adopt these, even though they're not as thoroughly worked as I'd like to see them be, because I would like to have them in hand when we're reviewing proposals next month.
Linda, would you like to make, wait a minute. Hi, Linda, would you like to make a recommendation? I mean, not a recommend, a motion to that effect?
Maybe after Heidi says whatever she's going to say. Okay.
Heidi?
I feel like this is just a brief outline of the potential goals. I don't feel like we've really fully fleshed them out. I think we need sort of bullet points under each one to explain what they mean, even. Like, I'm not sure what vocational programs means, or fair housing, or, you know, I mean, I have my definition of those things, but I don't know what the commission is thinking. And in order to achieve goals, you have to spell them out in a more definitive way of, we're going to do this, and these are the subheadings, and who wants to work on this? And if no one wants to work on it, then it's not a goal that's going to be achieved. So I think a lot more work needs to happen on just defining what the goals are. And I'm sorry, we have to keep coming back and saying there's more to do, but if goals are important and we really want to achieve something as a commission, we need to define what our goals are for this year. And we have not done that.
Linda Reed, and then Jackie.
So I wonder, I mean, each of you came up with these goals. I mean, some of you came up with them together, or they're goals that you share, but some of you came up with them because they were something that you wanted or that you prioritized. And so I wonder if maybe in the interest of just trying to get through things, if before we revisit these, if everyone could take them back and put those bullet points under those ones that they had the most interest in. And then when we come back, we could compare bullet points and then see if everyone's on the same page, and maybe where those intersections are would be where the work would get done.
Linda, should we send email to you?
Yes. Yep. And I'll compile them.
Jackie?
Well, I was just going to say that there is some specificity when you look at the alternative shelter solutions. They're described. The mental health, there's a couple of things, both of which I think we understand what those are, the CAHOOTS model and implementation, that we would like to focus somehow on that. And then the workforce housing, I think those also give us some idea on, we want to be better educated about the, you know, the UBG. Then food resources, focusing on the food distribution rather than the food resources, that's pretty clear. It's really when we get, and the work with the Energy Action Plan, I think that's more education, probably with Stu Green and SEEP. It's the last two that I don't, you know, I think if those were taken off, we could agree to focus on those other ones, but that's just my thinking.
I agree with that, but I'm still saying that if you want to do a CAHOOTS program, how feasible is it to get the funding, that you have to have full-time staff? It's great to say this is an aspiration for Ashland, and it's been going on in Eugene for several years, very successfully. But is it something we have any hope of achieving this year? And maybe if we talk it up or incentivize it for some existing agencies to participate, that would be maybe the starting point. But just to say we have a couple models is just not enough to justify calling it a goal. And so I agree with more specificity, but also what's feasible. And somebody mentioned that we implement our goals through our grant awards. I've also said this before, that I would appreciate, not this year, but putting out a specific RFP for that correlates to one of our identified goals. And I think that would make sense. This is one of the most empowering things we can do, is to award money to local agencies. And we don't really herd them together and say, this is what we want to hear. This is what we want to see implemented. But I think we need to focus more on specifics.
Okay, Gina, did you have something?
Linda did.
Linda.
Linda Reed had her hand up.
I just wanted to sort of reiterate what Tom said, but maybe narrow it even a little bit, which is, what is within your realm to influence? Mm-hmm. So to some extent, like the CAHOOTS model, like prioritizing the CAHOOTS model is a good goal, but what will the commission's role be in prioritizing that? Will it be if a CAHOOTS model is put forward by the county and they're asking everyone to put money in and they submit a grant application, then would the commission recommend supporting that? But I mean, I don't think the commission is going to be in a position to implement that CAHOOTS model on their own. So maybe in that narrowing of the goals, really thinking about it with an eye toward what is within your realm of influence and how would you be able to support or implement those things with the tools that you have.
Okay, so I'll be quick, because something that I have to agree with Heidi on, it's so much here. So to be able to put those sub bullets under, what does that look like? And maybe delete some of the things like CAHOOTS. CAHOOTS, Tom, is ongoing. The conversation, looking at it countywide, things are being put in place. So I am very hopeful for that. And I believe that maybe this does need a little bit more of what does that look like. And something that I do know is I know I'm not a voting person anymore. And I don't even think I can't say anything. I'm just giving suggestions and taking notes. So I don't know, Linda, can I say anything or I'm not? I don't think I'm supposed to. That's my two. I can give suggestions, right?
You can. So I think the direction we've been given in the past about commission liaisons is that you shouldn't express opinions to the commission on something you're going to be voting on later. So that, because then you could be unduly influencing this recommendation body before it gets to council. And that really has to do with something like CDC.
I've got it. I want to influence you. That's my purpose. No, I'm kidding. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, so I think where we last left it was that we are going to address specifics under these goals that we specifically, particularly want to see there, if there's those, and then revisit it again. Is this another one that will go off to April? So, I think we're aware of the goals, and so we're not going to lose them, but we will refine them in April, and particularly looking at places where we can form work groups if it's a high priority and put some people power behind it.
Did you want to adopt the goals this time, though?
Well, Linda, you kind of wanted to, but I think we could not, but go ahead.
I would like to adopt them. I'm not hearing that there's agreement about that, but I just want to go on record that I think I would like to adopt them. And I also would like for us to prioritize this maybe over having guest speakers in March as a higher priority for us as a commission, because, you know, a quarter of the year is already over. It's, we need to do this. And we need to do this, I think, more than we need to have guest speakers.
Unfortunately,
so no, I'm not going to make a motion because I don't hear that there's support for a motion.
Oh, I would second it, Linda, if you make a motion, because I think we need to have goals. I think it would be, it's important. And can we make them better and refine them? Yes, we can. But we're running out of time. So I would support the motion.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's been moved and seconded by Jackie. So we can have more discussion about this. I think the motion is self-explanatory, but what we do after that is what we could continue to refine. So not hearing any other discussion, Heidi, were you were into it. Okay, go ahead and unmute.
I have a question. If we adopt the goals, does it go to the city council as these are our goals for the year, or do we get to refine them first?
We can refine them first. Yeah, I have not heard that the council is doing their goal setting yet. And so we only send our goals to them sort of at the time when they do their goal setting so that they can take our goals into account when they do that process.
Okay, thank you.
Gina?
Unmute.
On March the 4th, we are going 4th and 5th. Council is going into goal setting.
Okay, well, maybe we should have this. Well, we couldn't even get it done before then.
No, so we can't. So my question is, can I mention this or no? Or should I wait and let the commission put it together and then maybe we could, as a commission and Linda and Rich, maybe you guys present it to council because goal setting is going to be March 4th and 5th.
Well, I would say that if we pass it as a motion, it's in the public record in the minutes of the meeting. And I don't see any problem with you mentioning that that's what we did at that meeting, with the caveat that we are in the process of refining them into more detail. But as a first blush, that's what our goals are.
Okay. Okay. If everyone feels good about that, I would love to make mention that this is what the commission is doing and that it is the beginning. It will change, a little finesse to it, but this is where you are right now, if I can.
So what will happen is generally what happens is the, you know, my boss, the community development director, will ask everyone who has a commission or who staffs a commission to forward the commission goals to him, to forward to the council in advance of their goal setting. So I will add that language to the bottom of this, and then will be what I forward to them, if that's okay with everyone.
Okay, Echo.
And something that's not written on this memo is in fact what we spent time talking about today. So I think it's a goal, which is to add a more detailed equity lens to the work of this commission and hope that that sort of equity lens, however we end up defining it, is adopted in the city as a whole, but starting with us. So that seems to be a de facto goal for us, even though it's not written down.
So I just, my concern about that is I keep feeling that we need to have an overarching, from the city manager council to the commissions, that it needs to be this lens that goes through all of the, and the departments. And so for some reason, for me, it feels like it's backwards, that housing and human services, I definitely want a racial and social equity lens. I support it completely. My concern is we're going to have a commission that is going to be social equity and racial justice. And they may want to have the lead on how that gets to council and the new city manager. So it just feels a little backwards to me. That's all.
Well, I think it's not necessarily that you know, we're doing it by ourselves, but I don't want to wait.
I understand.
I don't want to wait for other people to act.
I hear you.
So it's sort of letting the other city entities know that we're having really detailed, serious conversation about this, and recognize that it certainly has implications for lots of other people. And we want to be part of that conversation.
Rich, can I ask, so what I would suggest is that you would amend the motion to add, and the language that I feel like I have gotten from this meeting is the development and prioritization of a template by which to evaluate grant applications. I mean, we can make it bigger than that, through a racial and social equity, social justice equity lens.
Yeah, and sure. And I think you could take off the last two, actually, of those goals, because I think you're going to have a little trouble explaining the vocational programs.
It was mentioned.
Yeah.
And I almost think that the template could be part of the fair housing goal.
We'll be here all night if you guys want to micromanage all of this.
You're right.
We never took a vote on the racial justice issue. So whatever we say about it, we didn't vote on it. And there was questions about it. So I don't see how we add it to the city council without the next discussion that we're going to have. So they can look at our minutes or something and draw whatever they want to. And Gina can talk about it. But I don't think we want to say that that is part of the formal position of our organization until we make it as such. So the Linda's recommendation is that we, or motion is that we accept the goals that we outlined as our goals that would get promoted by us to the city council, but with the notion that we're going to refine them. So if everyone is in favor of that, wave your hands. Okay, anybody opposed to it, wave your hands. And so that's been carried, and that's where we'll go. And we have only a few minutes, but we should be talking about another very substantive issue, but maybe we'll have to postpone it, of the having donations go into the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. So Linda Reed, did you want to start us out with that? I know there are some people in the community that are in favor of that.
So this was actually talked about at the December retreat. But I did know that this was something that had a process had been established. I just wasn't sure what the process was. So the documents I included in your packet do outline the process. And the process is essentially that, yes, we can accept donations there that can go into the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. They are not a separate fund. They are part of the city's general fund. And then because of that are subject to the city's donation policy, which is attached. And so, yes, we can accept donations, and that's something that I think Jackie brought up as being something that we could advertise. And I have to apologize. I did have a community member who wanted to be here to hear this discussion. And while we were having some discussion, I checked my email and she emailed me that she was not able to get into the meeting. And I did send her an additional link, but she hasn't come. So I'm not sure if she just gave up on us or what. So anyhow, I guess what I would say is, do you have questions about the policies that are attached? Or, you know, what it looks like to have people donate, or how we could advertise that, or maybe just talk about next steps.
I was going to do this because I was working on my will and trust, which I already had to complete because I didn't get the information about how to do it. So I'm still confused because this memo from 2018 or the policy memo from 2018 is a little confusing to me, so I don't really understand what I'm reading. But I do think that I would like to see something a little more user-friendly, less legalistic, that would let folks know in the city newsletter or someplace that, hey, you know, if you really want to support the housing trust, here's how to do it. And if every single donation has to get voted on by the city council, that seems a little cumbersome to me. So I think we need to have more conversation about how to do this, because this seems weird.
So I, through our whole discussion, what had happened was, years ago, we had a city or a housing commissioner who passed away, and his wife wanted people to be able to donate to the Affordable Housing Trust Fund in his name. And we actually just said, okay, sure, this is what we'll do. We talked to the finance department, people sent us checks, and we sent them to the finance department and they went right into that account. No problem. Nobody accepted them. It was very simple. So that city attorney left the city and we got a new city attorney. And so I broached the topic with them and said, well, you know, we've done this process before. So, you know, what does the process look like? And this is what the new city attorney told me is the process. So this is the process. And while I think it would be nice to have something easier, I don't know that we can decide that. It would definitely be up to the city legal department how those donations would be processed. And maybe it's a numerical value. You know, it's, I mean, I think that this all came about, I mean, just looking at the date, because of the of some other donation that was given to the city and was accepted and then caused some controversy. And so then it became, well, the city can't accept donations unless we go through this process so that the city council can make sure that it's not a controversial issue to accept it.
I mean, this is just not usable to me. Like, if I had actually been able to put this into my will and trust, my $10,000 that I might have designated to go to the city in 25 years when I die. You know, these are these approval criteria just seems goofy to me for something like that.
So what I can do is discuss with my boss, Bill, the community development director, maybe a different way, and then talk with the city legal department and the finance department about a different way of doing this. Like I said, we had a different way of doing this. They were much smaller donations and they were, you know, what do you call it? A bequeathment, but.
Mm-hmm. A bequest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Linda Rapon.
Well, just having done this for nonprofits for a long time, when you make a donation, for example, to a foundation, your contribution is the priorities and the rules and the ground, you know, the governing documents of the foundation. So it's not like giving money just to the city. You're giving money to a defined fund. So then however the fund is used is at the discretion of the city in perpetuity. So it seems to me a little, it's worth revisiting, maybe revisiting after we have a new city manager. But it doesn't, it seems like it's an awkward thing for an existing trust fund.
Well, let me say that I've heard from someone in the community that their interest was in promoting Ashlanders to donate their COVID $2,800 or $1,400 to this. And if we all did that, we'd get a lot of money. And so there's value in that. I would speak against it, or at least I would caution that giving people who might make decisions on how we would get tax money in there. I mean, the amount of money that we're going to get through donations at best is going to end up being $10,000 or $20,000, regardless of what we think, or even if it was $50,000 on a one-time basis, it gives the people who would vote against a tax, they would say, well, why don't we just encourage people to donate? And encouraging people to donate doesn't get you much. It gets you a little. And anybody that's had nonprofits knows that you get some. And so I just worry that we give up the thing that we need, which is designated revenue from a tax for that. But I think we're going to do it at the next meeting, whatever. So is there more discussion? Linda, do you have something to take? You have something that you can take back? Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to Bill and to Dave Lohman and Cindy Hanks in the finance department to find out if we really have to go through this much more cumbersome process, or if there's maybe an amount of money, like a limit. Because I guess I see it in that sense that it's like, if someone wants to donate $250, do they really have to go to the council? That seems, yeah, onerous. And I'm sure it would be a consent agenda item, but still, like, waiting for that process and having to go through that process is kind of a lot, especially if we're getting, you know, $20, which, I mean, I think we got like $100 donations the last time. So if I had to write a council communication for like $200 every time we got a $200 donation and bring it to the council, that would be, and go to the council meeting and sit there in case they have a question. I mean, that just, it would cost more in staff time to do all that than it would to get the donation. So yeah, I will see if we can make this a little less cumbersome, and then I'll come back with you or to you and tell you.
Thanks, Linda.
Heidi?
I could see that the issue with the council might be if someone donates land or a house, then it's complicated because, you know, but if it's just donating cash, that it should seem very straightforward and easy to me.
We'll find out. Okay. So moving on to liaison reports. So Gina, did you have anything you want to add to us?
You know, I just, looking at the time, I guess not, but something that I wanted to do is, I want to be able to, if you have questions of the council, and like we touched on today, my voice is limited. I'm listening to you, and I really can't make too many suggestions because things are out there that still are going to be voted on. However, my request from you is to let me know how I could be a better service to our commission. And because that's what I get to do, take things to council and say, you know what, we need ABC. So please, please, maybe when everybody's making their list regarding our goals that have been set and things like that, you might want to jot down some things to Linda could give to me about how I could present things to council and be better service for the commission.
I think you've already reached the top 10 of council liaisons by showing up.
Well, I'm always going to be here, guys.
Heidi, and then Chris, do you want to say something from SOU? No? Okay, Heidi.
I just wanted to say, Gina, that it's a two-way street. Some of our best liaisons have informed us of things that were coming up that we might be interested in, and we could share our opinions on the issues at hand. So you don't have to just listen. You can also report to us on things that you're considering as a council.
Great, thank you.
I will, and you know, just knowing that we are going to be doing our goal setting ahead in March, the first part of March, so that that can be there and what I can say and what I can't say, but definitely I will have my ear out for everything that's coming in our direction when it comes to the commission. Thanks, Heidi.
Okay, Linda, staff, and next meeting.
I don't have anything to report on at this time. There's just a lot going on always. So I'm sure we'll catch up on it soon. And then for the next meeting, sort of what I heard was that maybe we should ask Ms. Kaplan to come at the April meeting and have the goal discussion at the March meeting. Does that sound okay? Okay. And then the other things we have is Echo Northwest, which is, you know, built into their schedule. We can't change that. And then we'll have the review and recommendation for the CDBG grants. And there's just two, so it shouldn't be as lengthy, and they're different. So it won't, it'd be a huge contest of, like, you know, too many things that are similar.
So,
yeah,
Linda, when will we get the grants?
So I will mail them to you tomorrow, email. I do have them ready to email. What I didn't have ready is the review sheets or the, you know, the scoring sheets for you. But now you'll be looking at them with a different lens, probably. But you can still have the plain old sheet that we always had.
God, you guys, I just love the discussions tonight. That's full participation. Thank you. But if we're done, I'll adjourn the meeting.
Oh, one thing. Do we know what the process is for putting in new members since Lita's here? Is Lita's application getting reviewed by Julie?
So, yes, we do know what the process is. It's not clear whether everyone knows what the process is. And so I did check. Lita and I touched base earlier this week. So she is in that process. And we're just making sure that everything is happening the way that it should happen. And then she'll get, you know, forwarded to the council for approval, essentially, on the consent agenda. I also, I guess the city recorder was not aware that we were down another person. So I did let her know that there is another vacancy. And so that is on there now, too.
Great job, guys.
Thanks, Rich.
Yes, thank you, and we'll see y'all soon.
Okay. Thanks so much. Bye, everybody.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good night.